The following is a public affairs presentation of AM 1220 WQUN. The opinions expressed on the following program do not reflect the opinions of the staff or management of WQUN or those of Quinnipiac University.
And good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Reporter at Large. I'm your host, John DeAndre, and with me this morning is State Senator Len Susio. His district covers Cheshire, Meriden, Middlefield, and Middletown. We're going to talk about a number of issues. We welcome him back to Reporter at Large. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. It's great to be speaking with you today, John.
Our first issue is a big one for you right now, the Connecticut mileage tax. It's getting a lot of press, and you're out there against it. Can you talk to us a little bit about what exactly it is and why it's not a good idea?
Well, the mileage tax, and unfortunately it's not just restricted to Connecticut, other states are considering it too, is a new form of tax for driving. Rather than tax you based on the gas you consume, it's going to be based on the miles that you drive. There are different variations of it. It can be a flat fee per mile, or it could be a variable fee depending on the time of day you drive or where you drive. It's what's called congestion pricing. So there's different forms for it to take, but it is nonetheless a tax, and it's intended to either augment or replace the gas tax. And it's been an experiment in a number of states up until now. It's become a controversy because the Department of Transportation signed a commitment to participate in a study of how to implement the tax and how to convince the public to buy into it. And I raised that as an issue during the campaign last year. It received a very strong response. Many people were very upset about it, not only because it represents another tax in already overtaxed Connecticut, but it also represents a real threat to privacy, because one of the ways and the main way they would implement this thing is through a GPS device installed in vehicles. So they'll not only know every mile you drive, they'll know everywhere you drive. And that has really got people's hackles up.
One of the press papers down Fairfield County Way described it as a sales tax by zip code.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things being discussed in government regarding taxing for driving, and there's what they call congestion pricing. That Senator Kennedy has proposed that. There's a bill floating around for that. There's all these different schemes, but they all boil down to how are we going to get more money out of people who drive vehicles in Connecticut and elsewhere. It's all about increasing tax revenues. And that people have got to understand that this is not about fairer pricing or pricing where you get a break. This is pricing to get more money to pay for road and bridge repair.
Is this modeled after any other plan across the country? Where did this come from?
Well, actually, there's been some form of it, I understand, in Europe and even in Australia. And there's mixed results about the whole thing. Of course, pretty hard to compare our country to Europe or these other countries because we're very different culturally. In the United States, there's been pilot programs. In Oregon, for example, there's been a pilot program, and they're testing in different states who are willing to participate and trying to get an idea of the best way to implement it and the most foolproof way. Because they know that, like anything else, John, that when you start doing things like installing GPS devices in people's cars, there's ways people can beat that. They can remove the GPS device. They can disarm it. They can play around with it. So they're trying to figure out the most foolproof way to implement the tax, and also the cheapest way in terms of administrative costs. Believe it or not, the gas tax itself is a very inexpensive way to collect taxes. They've already got up all the points, and they actually collect the federal tax at the wholesale point. So there's only like 750, 780 collection points around the country. Even though there's hundreds of thousands of gas stations, it doesn't really come from the gas stations. It comes from these collection points that it's remitted to the government. And it's the cheapest form. Even every study they've done so far, John, indicates it's far cheaper than even this new proposed mileage tax.
You sat out in the state Senate for a couple of years, and now you're back. What you're most noted for probably was your push on the gas taxes the last time you were in the state Senate. Are we going to see that again?
Well, Connecticut's unusual in that Connecticut has two taxes imposed on gasoline. One everybody's familiar with. It's 25 cents a gallon, very much the same as Massachusetts, for example. But there's a second gas tax in Connecticut called the petroleum gross receipts tax. That's a tax that's not based on a flat rate per mile. It's based on the percentage of the price, the wholesale price of gas. So the higher the price goes, the more the windfall for the state of Connecticut. When gas was pushing $4 a gallon back 4 years ago or 5 years ago, Connecticut was reaping something like $65 to $70 million more per year in gas tax revenues because of the fact that people were paying more per gallon due to the petroleum and grocery receipts tax being based on the price per gallon. It was literally hitting people in the pocketbook exactly at the wrong time when you can least afford it. And I made that a big issue when I was in the Senate back in 2012 and was able to put enough pressure on the Democrats with the assistance of people like in your audience who there was a huge public outcry because I educated the public about this. Most people didn't know about it. In fact, I didn't know there were two gas taxes until I got up to the Capitol and stumbled on it one day. So with the public outcry we had, we were able to to implement a cap on it so that if gas got up to $3 a gallon, the gas tax, the petroleum and gross receipts tax, could not go any higher. And I learned probably my most important political lesson in that experience, John. And the lesson I learned was this. You can't get anything done up in the Capitol, particularly when you're in the minority party, unless you get the public behind what it is you're pushing. And I learned that that meant I had to educate the public, make people aware, in this case, of that particular issue was the, you know, the fact there was a second tax and it was based on the price per gallon. And then you had to give people a means of expressing themselves. So that's when we started petitions up. We had rallies and that kind of thing and just kept it going and going. And it's interesting. Some of the Senate leadership came to me and said, this is great politics, but you know, you're never going to get it passed because the Democrats will never go for any kind of a tax cut or cap even. And it was kind of a joke for a while. But I said, I didn't come up here to get along. I came up here to get things done. And so I kept hammering away. And it took from June of 2011 until March of 2012. So it was about 7 or 8 months in one rally after the other, constant appearances on radio and TV and just pounding away when the Democrats finally raised their hands and surrendered and said, OK, we'll implement the gas tax cap. And that was a very valuable lesson for me, John. And I've sworn that my constituents are going to be the best educated voters in Connecticut. I want them to know everything I can get to them about things going on at the Capitol. And then, you know, we're trying to give them a voice up there.
If you look back at the time you were doing all of this, the gas prices were through the roof. The gas prices
yes.
are kind of benign now, and I'm not sure if they're going to go up in the future or not.
Well, you know, there's been a revolution in terms of technology with fracking and things like that. And so it has helped keep the price of gas down, which has been great for Connecticut because God knows our economy is still lagging behind everybody. The jobs haven't been recovered. And we're one of the most taxed states in the country. So it's been giving us a reprieve as consumers and payers of gas taxes. But you never know, John, and you've got to be prepared that they're going to collect more taxes. In fact, that's one of the arguments and the reasons they're making for this new mileage tax that you and I were talking about a few minutes ago. They're saying, well, people are driving more conservatively now. They're trying to conserve fuel, which is great for the environment, you know, global warming and all that stuff. But that hurts the government because we're not collecting the taxes we used to collect. Ergo, we need a new form of tax to collect for people who drive. And that's one of the rationales they put forward for trying to get this new mileage tax implemented to augment what they're getting under the gas tax.
So we very well may see some rallies again before the year is out.
Oh, I have every plan in doing that. In fact, we had a terrific hearing at the state capitol what you and I are going to be talking about in a minute regarding another proposal of mine, which is related to this. This $300,000 that we're spending on a study regarding the mileage tax, which the governor and every politician up in the Capitol says they don't want any part of it, they're not going to implement it, but nonetheless, they committed to spending $300,000 on a study about how to implement it and how to convince the public to buy into it. So I have a bill up in Hartford, Senate Bill 76, which basically is in front of the Transportation Committee right now. There was a public hearing a week ago, and we had a tremendous showing. The room was standing room only. I have proposed that we repeal that $300,000 commitment to that study, which is an exercise in futility and a waste of taxpayer money. And I propose that we take the $300,000 and restore the money to the Veterans Honor Guard Fund, which was raided by the Malloy administration to help balance the budget. That's the fund where we pay for military honors at the funerals of the men and women who have served our country through military service. And here we go. We don't have the money to continue honoring the people who put their lives on the line defending the country, but we've got money to spend on a gas tax, not a mileage tax, that every politician in Harper says they have no intention of implementing. It doesn't make sense, John, and it's a question of priorities.
You're listening to Reporter at Large on AM 1220 WQUN. Good morning. I'm your host, John DeAndre, and with me this morning is State Senator Len Susio. His coverage area is Cheshire, Meriden, Middlefield, and Middletown. Our conversation continues in a moment, but first, this programming note. Connecticut Radio Network's Dialogue 2017 follows this morning's Reporter at Large. And we continue our conversation, Senator Susio. Let's take a look at the tolls. We're hearing about tolls, electronic tolls, as a way to solve the budget crisis. Are tolls feasible in Connecticut?
Well, the short answer to that is no, under most circumstances. And the reason is that what's called the Federal Highway Act, where we've received millions and tens of millions of dollars from the federal government to build our highways, our interstate highways in Connecticut, I-91, I-95, I-84, for example. And one of the prohibitions in the Federal Highways Act is that a state that's accepted federal money for the construction of those highways is forbidden to implement tolls on those highways unless they get a waiver from the federal government. Rhode Island, for example, asked for such a waiver a year or two ago for I-95 so they could start tolling everybody coming from Connecticut into Rhode Island, and they were denied that waiver by the federal government. Other than that, technically you're not allowed to put tolls up on the highways that have been paid for by federal monies. There are a couple of other ways you can get around it. The feds have what they call these pilot programs, and they will allow you to put a toll on a highway if it includes the construction of a new lane. So you put a new lane onto I-91 or I-95, let's say, you can put a toll on that new lane. That's one way you can get around that. The problem there, of course, is you got to put the new lane in at the cost of gazillions of dollars, and it's going to take years before you can finish that. You've got all the complications with the bridges that you've got to go under and widening the road. So that is not likely to happen here in Connecticut. And then the other exception would be what they call congestion pricing. That's where they'll be allowed to charge you a toll depending on what time of day you go through an area, and it's got to be a variable toll. So if you're down in Stamford or Norwalk or even in New Haven, they would be allowed to charge a higher toll during the rush hours, for example, and then a lower toll during the non-rush hour time of the day. That is potentially possible here in Connecticut. And in fact, Senator Kennedy's introduced a bill to do just that. But they are called value price pilot programs, VPPPs, by the federal government. And they have the term pilot program in it, which would lead you to believe that, okay, this is temporary. They're experimenting with it. But I've had discussions with the people from the Federal Highway Administration, and they've told me that these pilot programs have a way of turning into permanent programs once they get implemented, because, of course, what's happening? They're collecting more taxes from the public. And that's just like a catnip to government. You know, you, you need to keep increasing those tax revenues to keep the bureaucratic beast going.
Well, if we're talking about tolls, and if in an honest way the money for the tolls is going to go pay for road infrastructure, would it be that bad of an idea? I mean, we are in sort of a crisis in some areas of the state with our road infrastructure.
Well, the problem, of course, is we've gotten to this point because there hasn't been an honest disbursement of the fuel taxes that have been collected. They've been diverted into other purposes, and now the government's crying, oh, we're broke. We need more money to do what we should have done in the first place. So in some sense, implementing tolls would be kind of like rewarding bad behavior. And again, we don't need too much encouragement to see taxes going up if you're a government official. It's just another form of taxation. And I don't know, people talk about a lockbox. You know, they use that term lockbox to make certain that the money is going to go for the intended purpose. But you take a look at it, John. For decades now, Connecticut's had different forms of raising revenue, whether it be the lottery or whatever, the petroleum gross receipts tax, the excise tax on gas. And it just gets siphoned off into other uses because the appetite for spending in Connecticut has no end. And that's why we're actually not in a budget crisis, John. We are in an unfolding catastrophe. Connecticut's financial situation is beyond disaster. It's catastrophic. I don't know if the public truly understands it. I think the public perceives that there's something wrong, that there is some problem here, that there's a crisis. But it's, in my opinion, it's even beyond the crisis phase. It's really catastrophic at this point. And I just don't know if the public understands how truly bad it is. And the only good thing about how bad it is it's going to force the powers that be to confront the real issues, which is not that we're under taxes, but that we're overspending. And we've had the two biggest tax increases in the history of the state of Connecticut since Governor Malloy came in when he inherited a $3 billion plus deficit. And guess what the deficit is that we're looking at for the next biennium? It's $3 billion plus. So two big tax increases and during the Malloy administration, and we're staring at the same number or volume of deficit that we had when the governor came into office at the beginning of 2011. This is where the people of Connecticut, there's going to be a bloodletting, I think, up in Hartford, unfortunately, because everybody's going to be scrambling to protect their turf. But it's going to be impossible, absolutely impossible, to sustain the status quo. Things have got to change. We've reached the point of no return now, and the patient is on the operating table and is expired. We're trying to bring the body back to life.
One of the offshoots of the budget, and it's a big one, is the pension situation.
Yes. There was a vote on the pension restructuring a week and a half ago or so, and it was on February 2nd, I think it was the date of the vote. Maybe it was February 1st, but whatever. We had a vote on it. It split along party lines in the Senate, 17-17. The lieutenant governor had to break the tie. The vote was to restructure the pension payments to state employees. And, of course, I was one of the people who voted against it. I voted against it, John, because it was a piecemeal solution. It was great that the state employees were willing to come to the table and basically allowed government to take advantage of them and stretch out the payments once more, which is what, of course, has got us to this point for the last 30 years. That's the same thing that's been going on. It was nice that they were willing to do that, but it basically avoids the confronting the real problem, which is that we cannot continue the commitments that we've made going forward, that things have got to be restructured. And that's why Republicans were united against the restructuring. I think if restructuring the pension fund obligations were part of a total solution, not a piecemeal solution, then it would have been a great idea. I was in the banking world for years, working with entrepreneurs and businesses. And every once in a while, you know, we were helping people start businesses, grow businesses, expand. But every once in a while, you'd run into a business that would have a problem. And we would work with businesses if we thought that they had a viable future. And what we would do is we would restructure their debt to buy them time to get back on their feet. Well, the pension restructure could have been done that same way. But a condition that we always had was that the business had to have a game plan to get out of the financial problem it was in. Because the state of Connecticut hasn't come up with that answer yet. So going along with this pension restructure was premature. It could have been a part of an overall plan of action to get Connecticut back on its feet. Not continue to increase taxes, restructure our obligations, change our obligations, and get Connecticut's economy going again, make Connecticut a much more business-friendly state with the way we enforce regulations and the tax policies we have. And then I could have supported something like that. But you cannot tackle a terrible, fatal disease in medicine without tackling the cause of the disease. And if you just treat the symptoms, the patient's going to eventually die anyways. And that's what we did. We basically treated the symptom without addressing the root cause. And that's why I voted against it. And that is why it was a bad idea.
We have a few short minutes left, and this is a big issue, too. It was an issue earlier in the decade. It still is every session, the early release program.
Connecticut had several versions of early release. There was what they call the statutory good time program. And then when Malloy's administration came in, they replaced that with what's called the Risk Reduction Earned Credit Program, RREC. Sounds funny or fancy, but it's just another version of early release. And the problem is that I don't know if we've ever had enough resources to really rehabilitate prisoners to begin with. But for sure, with the budget crisis going on, we're depleting whatever resources we have in our prison system to rehabilitate prisoners. So the failure to rehabilitate prisoners means that we're basically letting prisoners out who have not been rehabilitated, and they're free to maraud and roam our neighborhoods and basically terrorize our families. And only a few weeks ago, actually in December, one of these prisoners, inmates, was discharged from prison, and he was given 496 days of early release credit, basically. And 11 days after he's released from prison, he's been charged with sexually assaulting a woman down in Fairfield County. I did a Freedom of Information Act request from the DOC and got a hold of their large database about prisoners who have been discharged early. And in the first 50 months, I identified 393 sexual assaults that were charged to these inmates after they were discharged from prison, and 100 murders, homicides, or acts of manslaughter charged to these prisoners who were supposedly rehabilitated, and they committed or charged with these crimes after they were released from prison. So to me, the proof is in the pudding. The program has not rehabilitated the recidivism rate. Even Mike Lawler, the Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy, who's the architect of the Risk Reduction and Credit Program, the last time he appeared in front of the Judiciary Committee a year and a half ago, he was bragging how recidivism was down. But the numbers he was using was showing that it was failing twice as often as it was succeeding, that it was failing more than two out of three times. And as a result, we're needlessly exposing the public to violent criminals who are a threat to our life and safety.
That's the last word. State Senator Len Susio, thank you for being my guest on Reporter at Large.